And now, the podcast about movies for people like movies. Welcome to Snubs.
Okay.
All right. This is Josh and Dan, and this is the Snubs podcast. How you doing?
Hi, everybody.
How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Good.
I'm a little tired. I just moved.
You did. This is an awesome apartment. We're recording in it now. You can hear the reflections.
Yeah. It's too bad that the listeners can't see the river view.
Yeah, but there is that.
There is that. It's pretty good. There's a window seat and everything.
East River. Well, we don't want to really... Do we want to triangulate
you? Let's not disclose my location in case this ever becomes insanely popular.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Well, so this is the Snubs podcast. We are talking about movies that deserve more recognition than perhaps they got for a number of criteria, including cultural relevance, box office success, and longevity.
Mm-hmm. So we did the first episode, which was introducing 1996, which is an interesting year in film. And we outlined our picks for what would have won the, or might have won, I should say, the popular film Oscar in that year. And so we talked about Independence Day last week, which was the only one that we could agree on.
Right.
And then maybe we should just give a brief rundown about our other picks were. So mine were First Wives Club, The Birdcage, Scream, and Twister.
And mine were Mission Impossible, That Thing You Do, exclamation point, That Thing You Do, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and The Rock.
Do you think people like said it like that at the time, and that's why it didn't make any money?
In pitch meetings? Like, I don't know about That Thing You Do. What about That Thing You Do?
Yeah, that's good.
It
that's,
made good money.
I feel like that's going to be a very difficult episode for us to record.
Because of the punctuation on everything?
Because you're just going to do that the whole time.
Oh, right, right.
So, yeah. So we are in the midst of our first debate.
Yeah.
So this is the episode where we're going to talk about First Wives Club and The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh boy.
One of these films will we will jointly agree, or if we can get to that point, that it should be amongst the five imaginary nominees for the popular film Oscar of 1996.
Yeah.
And it will go on to the final bout, which we will record in a couple weeks, along with whatever along with Independence Day and whatever else we choose.
Yep.
So that's kind of where we are.
One will emerge victorious.
So I think we're going to talk about First Wives Club first.
Great.
And then we'll talk about Long Kiss Goodnight.
Bring it on.
Okay. Let's do it. What can we say about First Wives Club? I feel like everybody's kind of seen this movie.
That's one big thing to say about it. Yeah, I mean, it was on TV pretty much constantly. I probably saw it 10 different times when I was growing up. Maybe not all of it at the same time, but...
Yeah. I feel like I only probably saw it like once in its entirety, and then like 20 other times in sort of bits and pieces on like TNT,
right,
or whatever else.
I don't think I ever saw the first, you know, 15 minutes of it, because I don't, when I watched it this time a week ago or so, I do not remember the beginning
so
at all.
So you had watched it for years not knowing the premise?
Pretty much.
Great. Okay. Well, it opened on the 20th of September, 1996. It was a very successful movie. It was number 11 of the domestic box office that year, with a $105 million domestic on an estimated $26 million budget. So it was pretty successful. It was directed by a guy named Hugh Wilson, who has a really interesting career. So he actually created... Do you ever see WKRP in Cincinnati? Does that ring a bell?
No, I haven't.
It's a very popular sitcom in like the, let's say, late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Which has a very famous Thanksgiving episode. But he created that, and then he wrote Police Academy.
Oh, my God. He's rich.
Is he?
Well, if he created all those characters, how many Police Academy movies were there?
Well, I suppose that's probably true. I mean, I guess it depends on his contract, but there were at least six.
I'm going to go ahead and say he's rich.
Okay, let's go with that.
Unless he has a terrible contract.
Yeah, maybe. I don't really remember any of them. They all kind of blend together.
I just remember Citizens on Patrol.
Right.
With David Spade.
Yeah.
As the skateboarder.
I feel like Estelle Getty was in that too. Then there's one there where they go to Miami.
Oh, I didn't see that one. I don't know. That sounds like a romp.
You know, those movies are bad.
They're horrible.
Okay.
But this guy got rich.
But he got rich, so Hugh Wilson got very rich. And with his money, he directed a couple more things. He made Guarding Tess in 1994, which is with Shirley MacLaine as a very difficult first lady. First Wives Club in 96. And then in 1999, he made Blast from the Past and Dudley Do Right, both Brendan Fraser vehicles. Huh. Blast from the Past is the one where he lives in a bunker with Christopher Walken and Sissy Spacek. Because they thought that the world was going to end during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But then it doesn't, and he's sent out to, I don't know, replenish their supplies or something like that.
But it's years later, right?
But it's years later, okay. And he's a grown man, and he falls in love with Alicia Silverstone.
Oh, wow.
Terrible movie.
This is so much like Encino Man.
Yes.
That's so weird. I never saw Blast from the Past.
There's probably something in there to... We could probably go deep on Brendan Fraser.
Brendan Fraser works well as a guy who from a different time.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Dudley Do-Right, he's a dumb Mountie. That is the premise of Dudley Do-Right.
Got it.
And then there's like a couple things here and there, but he didn't really do anything else again. So I think that, you know, this was among his most successful films. It was based on a book by Olivia Goldsmith, who was a prominent female writer at the time, who wrote a lot of books like The First Wives Club, I guess you would say. And then, very sadly, died of during a routine facelift.
The author or the director? Really?
Yeah.
A routine facelift?
Well, I mean, I guess she just got them regularly, and one time she had some complications.
Shit.
That would be crazy if Hugh Wilson died during a routine facelift. Yeah. No, it was Olivia Goldsmith.
That is sad.
Yeah, it is sad. Some of her books were published posthumously. Mm. Apparently, she had a very difficult life, in part because it sounds like she had gone through some of these similar experiences.
Yep.
And it happened in this movie. So that's kind of the context for the movie itself. And then, obviously, you have like the most... I think out of all of the movies that we are talking about,
yep.
This one has the most stacked cast.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were going to say also musical has numbers.
Well, we're talking about That Thing You Do. That is about...
That Thing You Do!
Okay.
Okay, second most.
Second most. Yeah, I think second most. This says two.
It's kind of a lot, actually.
It is kind of a lot. No, but the most stacked cast.
Yeah.
So... Goldie Hawn, Bette Midler, and Diane Keaton are the main trio. But then I hadn't seen this in a long time.
You know, I have to say, I don't think that's true at all, because we got Independence Day on here, and we also have Twister. Yeah, between these two movies,
does
maybe.
Does Alan Ruck count as a member of stacked cast?
Twister? Well, we'll talk about it.
Okay. But here, let me run this down,
okay,
because
go ahead.
I feel like you're going to... So you get Maggie Smith. You have Sarah Jessica Parker.
Right.
You have Dan Hedaya, who's a wonderful character actor who plays Bette Midler's husband, Morty.
He's great in this.
Stockard Channing is the friend, Cynthia Swan Griffin, who sadly kills herself at the beginning of the movie. Victor Garber is one of the husbands. Mm-hmm. Stephen Collins from Seventh Heaven is one of the husbands. Elizabeth Berkley, fresh off of Showgirls.
Oh, my God.
Marcia Gay Harden plays the psychiatrist. Bronson Pinchot plays the gay interior designer. And Philip Bosco plays Uncle Carmine. It's a crazy IMDb list.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it such an enjoyable movie to watch because people keep popping up.
It's a lot
they're
of
all
really,
great in it.
Yeah, they're all great, and it's a lot of really, really good character actors.
True.
And I think we'll get there, but that's one of the things that really works for me about this. For the stars themselves, Goldie Hawn, Bette Midler, and Diane Keaton were all like, I guess, at pretty positive points in their careers. So Goldie Hawn, was doing these kinds of comedies at this time. She had been in House Sitter. She'd been in Death Becomes Her. Bette Midler was coming off of, as you rightly pointed out before we started recording, coming off of Hocus Pocus with Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah, they like working together.
And then Diane Keaton had just made Father of the Bride 2. And this is right before she wins her Oscar is nominated for her Oscar for Marvin's Room, which comes the next year. And then Maggie Smith was in Sister Act 2. I forgot about that. I wanted to make sure I said that.
But she had a long career, right?
Well, yeah, she's had a very long career, but, you know.
Was she doing things when she was younger?
I think so.
I mean, she would have had
There's a movie that's out right now called Tea with the Dames.
Uh-huh.
It's where it's her, and Judi Dench and Joan Plowright and somebody else whose name escapes me just sitting down and gossiping about their careers. It's supposed to be pretty good.
That sounds amazing.
Anyway, when I think of Maggie Smith, I remember Mother Superior.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I mean, I think that that's really all there is to say about the cast at the moment. We could sort of talk about any of these people for a long time. I guess the one other thing that I want to say is I think we should take a moment to recognize what a hardworking actor Dan Hedaya is.
Go for it, man. Run it down. I mean, I couldn't name what I've seen him in, but just like...
But you just, you know that you've seen him in a million things.
Yeah.
Right? I was looking at his IMDb page, and it's great. In 96, he was in Daylight, which is that Sylvester Stallone movie where they get stuck in the Holland Tunnel.
Yeah.
Ransom, and Freeway, which is that movie with Reese Witherspoon. And then 95, he was in Clueless. He was in To Die For. He was in The Usual Suspects.
Oh, my God. I forgot he was in Clueless. That's huge.
Yeah, that's. I think that's the role where most people remember him the most,
yeah.
I suspect. He's still working. He was the voice or the face or something of a goblin in Fantastic Beasts 2 years ago. Oh,
okay, I thought you were going to say Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, so I guess we could talk a little bit about the premise. Four old friends from college. Well, there you have four old friends from college. All of their husbands have left them for younger women. Very sadly, the one played by Stalker Channing, Cynthia Swan Griffin, kills herself earlier in the film. All of them have become estranged, but her death brings back, brings the other three friends back together. They're kind of financially and emotionally struggling with what to do, and they decide to put their heads together and take down their douchebag husbands.
They are all the worst.
They are all
They're all horrible.
They're horrible.
There's no redeeming qualities in any of them.
Really terrible people. And then they succeed. Spoilers and open a crisis center for women as a result. And that's kind of the movie.
Paid for by their rich husbands.
Yeah, there's not really much of a plot to this film.
Well, it's very hard to follow. I have to say, if you try to follow the different storylines, because.
It does sort of lose you there a little bit in the middle in terms of how they're blackmailing who or whatever. It doesn't matter though. That's the thing. It's really just a string of different scenes where they all get to sort of like vamp.
And watching these three actresses just have the most fun ever.
Yes, I think that you observed last week that this would have been a very fun movie to make. And as I was watching this again, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, they're just having a blast. The second they get together, you know, there's that first scene where they're having lunch together after the funeral, and they all start crying.
Yeah.
Except for Diane Keaton, but she's amazing in this when she starts to come out with her reasonings. And
I am arguing for this movie. I'm not going to argue for Diane Keaton in this movie. One of the things that doesn't work for me.
I love her, we'll get there. Yeah. The opening scene where the four of them are together in college... They really nailed Sarah Jessica Parker's lookalike, younger.
Wait, who? Not Sarah Jessica Parker. Who? Which one?
The younger version of SJP.
But SJP isn't among the four.
What?
Sarah Jessica, it's Bette Midler, Goldie Hawn, Diane Keaton.
Goldie Hawn.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
What
okay,
am I
okay.
talking about? Yeah.
Yes. One of the
young
things
Goldie
that works...
Hawn is perfect. Young Diane Keaton's pretty decent.
They're all really good. So when I wrote down what kind of worked for me about this movie, they really did that initial casting well, and they got the voices right and everything.
Yeah,
super impressive. Well, so let me ask you the question. So I'm going to argue for this. You're going to argue for Long Kiss Goodnight. But let me ask you this: we both like each of these movies.
Yeah,
I think that we would love to sort of see both of them make the final five. Sadly, it's not going to be the case.
No.
But what works for you about this movie?
What works for me about this movie, like I said, the first thing I said about it is, and it's the main thing for me, it just is a lot of fun. You're watching these wild performances. I guess they're not, I had said Diane Keaton's incredible or some other word like that in this. Really, it's just it's incredible to watch all three of them because they're all so big. They're all like... acting like their life depends on it. They're just having a blast, and it seems kind of like, you know, the Apatow style, just like friends hanging out, improv comedy stuff. So that is really fun. It's very easy to root against the husbands because they're just the worst. You're kind of just sort of driving with them, and it doesn't really ever lull. It just kind of moves, and it's like watching them quickly come together, quickly come up with one zany plan after another to get rid of their husbands, and then eventually just, you know, winning the movie.
They win the movie.
It's fun.
For sure. It's not the first husband's club.
No.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think I agree with you on most of that. Mm-hmm. I think the things that work for me like the most in this are Goldie Hawn and Bette Midler, uh-huh. First of all.
Oh, wow.
I think they're both great. And they have really good chemistry in a way that I think Diane Keaton never sort of cracks into the sort of dynamic. But there's that scene when they're in Goldie Hawn's apartment, and Bette Midler and Goldie Hawn are sort of really sort of digging deep and sniping at each other, and it's you're seeing really two very, very talented comedic actresses go at it, and it's great. It's a joy to watch. I love the fact that I love this cast. It's so good. I mean, even though the husbands are obviously all douchebags, like all three of those actors are really wonderful, and they do an excellent job sort of delivering on those sort of very nauseating characters.
Yeah.
And in particular, you don't really see Victor Garber playing a douchebag that much, I don't think. Props to him. The young actors, the music, they have a great score that I still kind of, you know, that's one of the things I remember most about this movie, that kind of dun 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 dun.
Nice.
Which was nominated for an Oscar. We should have said that this movie did receive an Oscar nomination for that.
That's right.
And then let's see what else. It's a pretty positive, I mean, you know, for the 90s, pretty positive LGBT message. You got Bronson Pinchot in there as like a helper, even though he is kind of a caricature. They do have a...
Kind of a caricature.
Well, he's completely a
caricature. He's entirely a caricature.
Yeah, I know.
But he's successful.
But it's okay. You know what? At least he's in there in a positive way. At least he's helping them.
Yeah, for sure.
And they have a nice scene in the lesbian bar.
Was nice.
Yeah.
And it has, what's her name from Orange is the New Black in it, which was really fun to see her as a young actress.
Oh, yeah. Leah DeLaria.
Yeah.
Who plays Big Boo or Boo or something
That's
like that.
That's what I was going for, yeah. I didn't know her real name.
Yeah. It was crazy. I saw it. That was a real surprise when she popped up. Love all the cameos. Ivana Trump pops up at the end. Mm-hmm. And then I do like that they have an office on Bond Street, which I would say is the thing that makes the least sense about this movie. But, you know, they went through the process of, like, renovating and designing a logo, and it's great.
It's a pretty fun idea. I like it that they're like, all right, we got to do this thing, but first we need, you know, just a building that's renovated and designed and furnished to be our club.
Yeah, well, because you can't take revenge on anybody without that.
Without three matching desks that face each other.
You can't just, like, hang... No. You can't just hang out in somebody's apartment and plot that kind of revenge.
Right.
What doesn't work for you about this movie?
What doesn't work for me about this movie? Well, I mean, okay, there's an image towards the end of... After they've taken their revenge of... I think it's a montage of all three of them just kind of like walking up to their husbands and having their husbands write checks, or ex-husbands, write checks, and then they go and spend it. And it just feels a little uncomfortable to me that the women who are really in control are still, you know, just having their husbands write checks for them. It just feels a little weird. The men
feels like
just
a little
seem
bit of a mixed message.
Yeah, entirely.
Yeah, I guess that's true. The checks ultimately are for the crisis center.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's okay. It's how about giving to charity.
How about a shot of, you know, of Bette Midler, like, going to the bank and printing out a statement, which now has, like, $20 million in it, and her husband's statement is just, like, you know, lint coming out of his pockets or something like that. That's what I would elect.
That's what you... Okay.
And then she can write her own check.
That's like I understand where you're going with this, and I appreciate that. That is a very specific suggestion for Hugh Wilson.
Yeah, can we give him some notes at this point?
He died earlier this year.
He died too?
Yeah.
Facelift?
No, he didn't die of a facelift. I think he died just because he was old.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, Hugh.
Yeah. Condolences.
But in the remake, I mean, just think about a movie, First Wives Club, that came out in 2018 instead of 1996.
Yeah, I mean, we are actually gonna talk about that, because there is gonna be a remake.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
Who's in that?
I don't think it's been cast yet. Oh, I believe it's gonna be a TV show.
God. Oh, TV show.
Yeah.
Okay. Crazy.
What else doesn't work for you about this?
You know, not a lot. I mean, it's a little slapstick in a lot of places. Like Diane Keaton reminds me of a Muppet certain times when she's sort of going back and forth with her head. She looks like she's, I mean, I was surprised that her performance doesn't work for you as well, because she's just going for it. I mean, maybe it's just that we see her so often in serious roles, or more serious roles, where she's not like...
Maybe. For me, it's just too much.
Yeah.
This is a little bit of a detour.
Yeah.
Did you see Book Club?
No, I didn't see Book Club.
Book Club is delightful. Everybody should go see Book Club.
Okay.
Love Book Club. But she really has, like... She has turned into... Like, that performance that she puts in The First Wives Club has become, like, the performance that she puts in a lot of movies. And in Book Club, it's the same thing, where it's like really slapstick and she's kind of falling all over the place. And there's, a very unfunny scene of her kind of flopping around in the pool. I'm not sure what happened there, because she kind of had the right balance in the middle, like around the something's got to give, like that kind of thing.
The middle.
Yeah. Well, just like the middle of her career.
I guess you would say. Oh, just a little side thing. Jill Scott is going to be in, The First Wives Club.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Love Jill Scott. So, that's good news.
That's awesome. And Michelle Buteau, who's in Broad City and Key and Peele.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We don't have a third lead yet.
Oh. Oh, Josh, you got to get down there and audition.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's really exciting.
It is. So what doesn't work for me is really, it's sort of like tonally, and you were alluding to this, tonally it's all over the place.
Yeah. Right?
So there is this insane slapstick scene where they're on the window washing
kind of the best
apparatus.
Scene.
And
kind of the best scene in the movie, I have to say.
Kind of the worst scene in the movie. definitely the worst scene in the movie. I just like... It would be better if they just picked a tone and stuck to it a bit. And so either they got to make it like a real slapstick comedy, or they need to make it a little bit more down to earth. But I think the premise of the film is very serious, right? Like, their friend takes her own life.
It is quite serious.
And the sort of the ending of the movie is really about how they can help women who are in a similar situation. So that stuff doesn't really work for me, and that's why Diane Keaton's performance doesn't work for me. She just seems demented.
Yeah, she is.
Half the time. And then all of a sudden there's a real turn at the end where she just like takes over her husband's company and is kind of cool as a cucumber.
Right.
That works a little bit better for me.
Yeah, it's great.
but excuse me. The tone is the thing that doesn't really work the most. And then I guess there's two other things that I would point to. I don't like movies where there is sort of this false conflict that is created amongst the
two friends,
amongst the protagonists.
Right.
And so sort of the falling out that Goldie Hawn and Bette Midler have, it's not...
But it allows Diane Keaton to kind of come out of her shell a little bit.
It does. There's a narrative purpose to it. It gets I do like the performance in that scene. It gets a little bit too nasty for me.
Yeah.
It does yield, and again, this is an example of the weird tone. It does yield actually a very nice montage that's set to, if I'm not mistaken, Love Is on the Way by Billy Porter. Great soundtrack, again, where they all sort of reconcile. And it's good, but I don't really love that. And then the thing that I really hate is the fact that Bette Midler and Dan Hedaya get back together at the end.
Yeah, it's pretty
brutal. That really bothers me.
It's quite brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that is a
he's a real jerk.
If Jill Scott is listening to this, that's a hot tip for the remake. Don't do that, please.
Yeah, I can't see that happening in 2018. Plus, it's going to be a series. So
yeah,
how is this going to be a series?
Well, how is anything a series these days?
But I mean, really, what are they going to? Are they going to have men to? Are they? Oh, is it a procedural where they like meet with other divorced women and just every week there's a new guy to destroy?
Law and Order, First Wives Club.
Yeah, exactly.
I really don't know. I mean, you know, TV now is just. Half of TV now is just a movie that's stretched out to 10 hours.
Maybe the best scene is where Sarah Jessica Parker, the real Sarah Jessica Parker, is at the auction with Maggie Smith, just buying all of Victor Garber's stuff.
Yeah.
That's kind of great. And then they bring it back together when he goes, I had a car like that.
Yeah. No, it was good. I mean, you know, it's not a. I wouldn't say it's an intricately plotted film,
right.
But it's really good.
Yeah,
I don't know what they're going to do with the TV series, but I was thinking about this the other day because I saw Widows. Did you see Widows?
How was that?
Widows rules.
Yeah,
love Widows.
Sweet.
But I was reading some review about it. I can't remember who wrote it. So credit to some person out there, but they made the observation that Widows. In any other form, probably would have just been a 10-hour television series that was like really stretched out.
Right.
But they just compressed it in exactly the right way, where you get all the same enjoyment out of it, which is such a tremendous level of narrative economy. And I do think that in a way, like that's something that the First Wives Club does fairly well, because it is a little bit thin on plot, but you do have these nice sort of character moments along the way, and they do fit in like basically 10 leads. There's a lot of people in this movie that you have to. You know, keep separate in your mind and care about it at least a little bit.
Very true. Yeah, I like it. It's a great movie.
Great movie,
man.
I think you know. Well, we're gonna talk about its commercial success and cultural relevance and so on. But let's talk about Long Kiss Goodnight first.
Yeah, for sure. This was my pick, and I was really excited to see this on the list of movies from 1996. I hadn't really thought about it in a few years, but. It's a movie that I come back and watch every, you know, 5 years or so. Shane Black is...
So wait, you've seen it 4 times.
Well, what did you do, the math?
I did.
I didn't do that much math for it.
Okay.
I probably saw it twice in the 90s, and then I came back and watched it maybe 5 years ago, I think. Mm. So there was a long break in there before I sort of realized how great it is. I think that I saw the movie Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis several years back with our friend JP.
Mm-hmm. Where is JP?
I don't know. JP, if you're listening, can you please come on our podcast and talk about...
Hi, JP. You could be our guest.
Yeah, come on in.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
But yeah, we watched The Last Boy Scout together, and he and I both just loved all the one-liners, and we realized the script was Shane Black, and looking into more of Shane Black's career, kind of knows how to write a fun action movie with just some lines that kind of just... He knocks it out of the park with several of these lines. And I'd like to go back and reminisce about a few of them from this particular movie. But just to tell you about Shane Black's career a little bit, started in 1987 when he wrote Lethal Weapon, Monster Squad, Lethal Weapon 2, The Last Boy Scout, Lethal Weapon 3, Last Action Hero, another great 90s movie, which I hope we can talk about
soon. Oh, that is a weird one.
Oh, my God. I loved it.
It when I was a kid. I'm not sure I would love that now.
We'll have to rewatch it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure either.
That would, what year is that?
93.
Okay. If we do 93, that has to be an undercard.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, of course, Lethal Weapon 4. He wrote all the Lethal Weapon movies. Oh, no. I guess he just wrote the characters of those, so he only wrote the first one. Long Kiss Goodnight, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is a pretty fun Robert Downey Jr. movie. Iron Man 3.
The best of the Iron Mans.
Yeah. He's good. He did good there, and The Nice Guys from 2016, which was a great...
Yeah, I really like that movie.
A fun one. So he teamed up with director Rennie Hartlin, who, Dan, you wanted to point out, he had just made Cutthroat Island with his wife at the time, Gina Davis, right before this one.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that?
I have not. Pretty good?
It's bad.
So it's a bomb that deserved to be a bomb.
Yeah, no, it definitely deserved to be a bomb. I remember seeing it when I was a kid and just thinking it was like a little bit weird and disturbing, because the whole sort of MacGuffin in that movie is a treasure map in three parts, but the treasure map is tattooed onto three different people's skulls, and so they have to like scalp the different people to get the different pieces of the map. It's gross. It's weird.
Wait, did I see this movie?
You probably did.
Matthew Modine.
It's really bonkers. It's sort of just completely narratively incoherent. But, you know, I do love Gina Davis.
Morgan Adams and her slave, William Shaw.
Yeah.
Okay.
You watch this stuff now and you think, a little problematic.
Okay, this looks a little... Yeah, maybe not. I don't know.
Rennie Harlan had made Cutthroat Island. Somehow he got the financing for Long Kiss Goodnight, and this was his sort of next, and I think in some ways his last chance to kind of make it in Hollywood, because I don't think that he made a big movie after this, if I remember correctly.
He made several movies after this.
But a big movie after this.
No.
I think he ends up, he's something. No. He's Scandinavian. He might be Finnish? I can't remember.
He is Finnish. He's actually the most successful Finnish film director in Hollywood.
Ooh.
I don't know who else is on that list.
But. You know what? Because he's not actually the most successful Finnish film director. That would be Aki Kaurismäki. That's kind of sad that he has to make that disclaimer or caveat.
In Hollywood.
on his IMDb page.
I'm sure he's living a very happy life. Is he still with Gina Davis or no?
They got divorced.
Well, maybe he's not happy then.
Yeah, maybe not.
Because she is the best.
She is the best.
She's the best in this movie, for sure. She's so awesome in this movie. I mean, she gets to play this character that starts off one way, almost like, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's like cartoonishly, but she's like the suburban housewife who, you know... gets annoyed at the neighborhood kid for smoking, and she can be a stern mom, but she's pretty much just this nice lady, but she has some sass to her. The Shane Black dialogue.
She's got a little sass, that's
she's
true.
Sassy.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
And then you see glimpses of this other character who she's playing, who is, I guess, the real Gina Davis, Charlie, who is a international spy and assassin.
Yeah.
Who's a total badass, but doesn't make any connections with anyone, and you know, can't be trusted or can't be loved and all that stuff. So
major difference is she's blonde.
Yeah,
she has a nice smoky eye.
Yeah, she does a lot of eyeshadow. Yes, yeah. It's very 1996, I think.
Yeah,
and shorter hair too.
Shorter hair too.
But the mole is on both characters.
Yeah,
did you notice the mole?
No.
There's a mole. It's right there.
Okay.
Yeah. No, for the next time you watch. I'm just
okay.
But then she somehow blends the two characters at the end. Mm-hmm. And Dan, I know that really worked for you. We'll talk about it. I'm not really sure it worked so well for me. But
So do you want to just run down the premise quickly?
Sure. Yeah. So basically, a woman with amnesia for the last 8 years has built a family in suburban. Is it Jersey where they live?
They do live in New Jersey. I'm not sure where.
Okay. In a nice place. It's around Christmas time. And her past starts to come back to haunt her. Well, actually, at first her past starts to come back just in little realizations that she can... I'm a little hazy. At what point does... Well, she gets in that car crash,
well,
right?
So that's the thing.
Yeah.
So she had amnesia as a result of, I guess, essentially getting shot and falling off the cliff.
Yeah.
Which you find out in flashback.
Yeah. And but she was 2 months pregnant at that time.
Yeah. In the first 15 minutes of the movie, she's driving home a lecherous, drunken neighbor.
Oh, yeah. That's where that first great line happens, where he says, "How are you and your husband? How often do you?" And he does the gesture of... finger through the hole in the other fingers, and he goes, "Put our fingers like this and put them together as often as we can."
Yeah.
Ah, it's hilarious.
But then there's a deer that crashes into the car. She flies through the windshield and hits her head, and that's what starts triggering the return of her memories.
She snaps that deer's neck expertly.
Yeah,
expertly. Meanwhile, like the guy in the car burns alive, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but do they talk about that at all? That he died in a horrible way?
I don't think so.
No, they never bring it up, do they?
I'm not sure.
Just happy family. Go back and have a happy family. But she starts to realize that she can cut food really well. Yeah. Which leads to her chucking a knife through a tomato at the door and scaring her family and saying, chefs do that. A great line that keeps coming back throughout the film. And then she has this really terrifying moment when someone breaks out of jail and tries to kill her and her whole family, but she takes him out in the same way that she took out the deer. Nice thing about this movie as it's happening is that you start getting introduced to the characters who are going to be in the film, and they're almost all of them are introduced doing something that's not really who they are. I noticed when I was watching it last night.
So what's an example of that?
So Gina Davis, you meet her, and she's the nice housewife lady. Samuel L. Jackson, you meet him, he's posing as a cop. In a prostitution bust, which is actually just sort of like a, I don't know what the con would be called, but he's conning somebody. using a bunch of homeless, drunk people as, and then his receptionist partner, I'm not sure, tells him, you gotta stop hiring these bums. And he goes, you pay him in food. It's great. And then she goes, oh, and then when they puke, is that a refund?
It's the line.
Oh, I love this. I love this script. I'll just keep saying it. But anyway, I watched it last night, so it's very fresh in my mind. But anyway, you were introduced to him as something that he's not. Also, later you meet the CIA head, I guess, Mr. Perkins. He's meeting with the president. He's really kind of a double agent. He's in the midst of a terrorist plot.
Yeah. Brian Cox is just Brian Cox. He just shows up and does his thing.
He's the best.
He is the best.
Even him, when you meet him, it seems like it's kind of like in an old people, like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Convolution home? That's not the right word.
Convalescent home.
Convalescent home.
Yeah, convolution.
It seems that way.
I would love to know what that would be.
A convoluted home.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, they're... You meet the people in great ways. Everyone's introduction scene really just brings you into who they're going to be as a character, even though they're showing the opposite of that.
So you love this movie.
I'm loving it more and more the more I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
You're smiling uncontrollably.
Oh, I love it. Okay, where did I stop in the plot? Pretty much minute 15, right?
We're pretty early.
She goes off with Samuel L. Jackson, who is a private eye she hired to and general kind of like sleazy dude. Pretty sleazy guy She hired to try and figure out who she was in her past, and she leaves her husband and her daughter, who've just, you know, both been in this traumatic situation where they were home invasion and, you know, attempted murder, to try and go figure out who she is. She goes with Samuel Jackson. They're both pretty supportive of her, despite the fact that it's a crazy thing to do. But she goes for it, and they go off on this sort of quest to figure out who she is with a couple clues. And, they meet Brian Cox, who's their handler, her old handler. They meet a man who she was, believes she was once engaged to, turns out to be a target. She gets put into a torture contraption, which brings her underwater into really cold water, where she sort of realizes who she was, comes back out, and goes on an absolute rampage. And
yeah, that's the moment where she sort of changes from Samantha Cain to Charlie Baltimore.
Exactly. That's the general premise. By the end of it, she has to sort of decide whether she's going to completely obliterate Samantha Cain from her life and the family, the daughter, the husband she left, or if she's going to find some way to reconcile the two characters. Yeah.
And she does.
She sure does.
Yeah.
In the midst of being a freaking hero.
A lot works for you about this movie. Is there anything that doesn't work?
Yeah, well, like, you know, as I was watching it, I kind of lost me towards the end. The last set piece when, you know, they're on the bridge and she's trying to figure out how to get out of this, you know, get out of it alive with her daughter, is great. But leading up to that, there's a lot of kind of like, you know, she's like, just go without me and stuff like that. And I don't know. It's weird where the daughter is around, I feel like. I do like... Maybe I just don't like the daughter. I don't love that actress. she's not killing it for me.
She was like 7.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, I can forgive that.
Okay.
This is a fantastic movie. There are you know, there are kind of too many endings, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
That's a thing that happens.
That's true.
Is that all of a sudden she puts on the Thelma and Louise thing and she's driving a convertible.
Mm-hmm.
Bandana, I guess.
Yeah.
She's driving in a convertible. The president calls and asks her to come back and work for him for the next term, I guess. I don't. It was kind of a weird moment.
Yeah.
She turns him down, goes off and lives in the country with her husband and daughter where they have sheep.
Yep.
And he says, we could do this forever, or I could just sit out here all night long, couldn't you? And she doesn't say anything, but instead she takes out a knife, which she was, I guess, using to like spread peanut butter, but she chucks it at a log and ends up killing a cricket who was annoying her, and they kind of look at each other, and he is clearly terrified of her.
That's one of the things that really works for me about this movie.
Yeah.
I love that they gave them kind of an ambiguous ending.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine if you were that guy that you would necessarily be like super chill about spending the rest of your life with a dangerous international assassin.
He said he wasn't scared of her. But I think he is scared of her.
He seems a little bit scared of her, and as well he should be.
Yeah, it may... Like, his reaction is the only thing that really gives us that edge, though, because the rest of the way it's set up, there's, like, this sweeping shot as it like, goes away from him and shows the idyllic life that they
sure.
have. And there's, you know, the music kind of swells. Well, it doesn't really swell. It actually goes to that song, Tracy Bonham's song, Free, which is... She's amazing as well. But it just feels kind of like the like happy sitcom ending where if there was a studio audience or laugh track, it would go...
Da-da-da. Yeah, but it has a little bit of an edge to it. And to be honest, like the thing that works most for me about this movie is that the entire movie has an edge to it.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's a little bit hard for us to see now looking back 20 years on. When this... I mean, to be honest, like there's some parts of this where you would see an action movie now and say, oh, well, The Long Kiss Goodnight is a little bit slow-paced.
Mm.
But I went back and I read some of the reviews at the time, and you know the reviewers who didn't like it were more often than not saying, "Oh, this is too vulgar. This is too violent. This is too much. It's in poor taste, etc., etc."
Wow.
Which is crazy in terms of how the culture has moved over the course of the last 20 years. Because if this was released now, nope, I don't think anybody would have those particular complaints.
It does have the feeling, though. You can feel it, like when that guy burns alive.
Yeah, for 1996, it's definitely pushing the envelope a little bit.
When she picks her daughter up and throws her through the window into the treehouse.
Now, I did not see this movie when I was a kid. I saw this movie later on, probably in college or something like that. But I have a very vivid memory of when this movie came out, because I was in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, visiting my mom's friends.
Okay.
And my mom and her friend Janet had gone to see this movie on like a Tuesday night or something like that. And they came back to the house and they were behaving like maniacs. They burst into the house. They were like making guns with their hands and their index fingers. They were like really jazzed about this movie.
Oh,
and they
awesome.
Apparently saw it in a theater full of women and everybody loved it.
Yeah.
It was not super successful overall.
Is that right?
I think it was number 46 at the box office or something like that. Domestic box office in 1996.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, it was further down the list. But I really do like the edge. And I really like talking about it in the context of the First Wives Club because I think both films are, to a certain extent, women who are coming to terms with the... emotional and in some cases physical trauma that have been placed on them by the men in their lives and finding ways to sort of conquer that and in some instances take vengeance in this case, very bloody vengeance because
yes.
Gina Davis kills the father of her child, who is the best total maniac played by Craig Bierko, in a really sort of nasty and explosive way at the end of the film. But yeah, I love this movie. I think part of me kind of wishes that I had picked it.
Sorry, Dan, we can't all be winners.
No, it's okay. But I love Gina Davis. Samuel L. Jackson has a great performance. This is one of my sort of favorite Samuel L. Jackson wisecracking sidekick performances.
Yep.
And even Craig Bierko is like putting in a pretty good performance as the sort of stone cold psycho. Yeah,
he's pretty scary.
Brian Cox pops up. Like it's really just
Brian Cox more than pops up.
Yeah,
well, he rules in this movie. Minutes, yeah, but it's a great 20 minutes. I actually want to look up his line when he first shows up. But so, go ahead, keep talking.
I love all of it. I have to say, I don't love the script. I like the story. I don't love the script.
What?
Because, and I'm not a super huge Shane Black fan, and I don't love the sort of corny one-liners. That's not really what works for me about this. I feel like there could have been a little bit less of that, and it could have been a little bit tighter. Because you're very right to point out that there are multiple endings to this movie.
I agree that it's not the smoothest script ever, but there are certain moments of it that are just like, oh my God, what a great line. And just for the record, you did just say you don't love the script, and you said that Brian Cox popped in, and I'm now going to read you his opening
let's hear
scene.
I want to hear it.
His character Nathan says, "Alice, please, your dog, Alice. It and my appetite are mutually exclusive." Alice says, "Well, what's wrong with the dog?" He goes, "Simple. He's been licking his asshole for the last 3 straight hours. I submit to you that there is nothing there worth more than an hour's attention. I should think that whatever he is attempting to dislodge is either gone for good or there to stay. Wouldn't you agree?"
Yeah, it's okay. I mean,
oh my God. Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that kind of stuff.
I loved it.
It's all right. I do think it's amusing to think about Shane Black like sitting in front of a typewriter somewhere, writing the script and thinking, well, there needs to be a line about a dog anus in here.
Yeah, you know, we didn't really run down Samuel L. Jackson's career, and I know it's a little late for that. But
Gina
at
Davis
that moment, did I not do Gina?
Let's
do Gina. So back to, I'm going to skip some of the TV stuff. Fletch, 1985. I forgot about that. Awesome.
Great movie.
Fletch, 1985, The Fly, Beetlejuice, Earth Girls Are Easy, she was in, The Accidental Tourist, Quick Change, some of these movies I don't really know, actually. Thelma and Louise, 1991, that was huge of her, A League of Their Own, Hero, big few years, early 90s for her. Then Angie, in 1994, she was in Speechless, followed by Cutthroat Island in 95, Long Kiss Goodnight in 96, and then a big break before Stuart Little in 1999. And in the 2000s, she has been in a couple things, but...
Yeah, this is the moment where her career really shifts, all right, because she kind of takes a real... I don't know if this is a personal or professional thing, and I don't really want to speculate too much, but...
Yeah.
This is the last role of this type, sort of an action heroine that she takes.
Absolutely.
And then she pops up in sort of mom roles, starting with Stuart Little.
Right.
League of Their Own is 92, I believe.
Yeah.
I hope that we can do 92, because I love A League of Their Own.
Oh, me too. Well, that's just a great movie.
It is a great movie.
That's a stacked cast.
That is.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Glorious. And then Sam Jackson, you know, before the Marvel stuff started happening, had a friggin' incredible career. There's no way I can go through all of it, but we'll just do I just saw Loaded Weapon 1. He played a character known as Wes Luger.
I forgot about Loaded Weapon.
Yeah. Jurassic
Park. For anybody
Park.
Who doesn't know what Loaded Weapon is, Loaded Weapon is a spoof of Lethal Weapon.
Oh, go watch that movie. Those movies.
We don't really have enough spoofs anymore, because there was also Hot Shots, which was a spoof of Top Gun.
Hot Shots and Hot Shots Part 2.
Hot Shots Part 2 is a wonderful.
Yeah, but we've got,
or is it? I don't know. Last time Part I watched deux? I was 12.
I feel like it is.
It was wonderful when I was 12.
I certainly feel that it is. I believe he has a mole in that movie that he keeps moving around his face.
That's true.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Okay, this is Mole Talk with Dan and Josh.
Okay, but just really quickly, you know, Sam Jackson, just an incredible presence in any movie. Great actor, but he really just like lights up a screen. Jurassic Park in 1993, also 1993, True Romance. Skipping around a little bit, he was in Pulp Fiction in 94. Kiss of Death in 95, Die Hard with a Vengeance in 1995, which I was seeing flashbacks to at the end of this movie because both films end with Samuel Jackson really, really bloody and in Niagara Falls, unless I'm mistaken. I know this one does. Die Hard with a Vengeance, I think they go to Niagara Falls at the end of that, or at least somewhere in Canada. But then also this year he was in A Time to Kill. After this year, he was in Jackie Brown, Sphere, Out of Sight, The Negotiator, The Red Violin, and then Star Wars Episode 1 in 1999.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty crushing decade. Yes.
And then he starts to get in on that franchise stuff, and then that's kind of it.
Yeah. Very true.
He's a wonderful actor. I love Samuel L. Jackson. I think that he's great. He's great in this movie.
Gotta agree with you. Yeah.
So great. Now,
what do you anything else to say about this? What else doesn't work about this for you, other than your insane take on the script not being good?
No, it's not that the script isn't good. There's just things that I like in screenwriting, and there are things that I don't like in screenwriting, and I just don't love the sort of overly jokey action movies where it feels kind of forced.
Well, you know, you're living in the right time.
I mean, my issue with both of these movies is kind of the same, in that they're like a little bit tonally all over the place.
Yeah, for sure.
And they can't just kind of stick to one thing. And I think that they both suffer for it a little bit.
I think the world of Shane Black characters is a world where people are in really, really serious situations, but they're totally okay with it. And they're totally cool under
really,
pressure.
It works better in some of his movies than in others. Like, I think it actually, he gets to exactly the right balance in The Nice Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When it's sort of a parody of itself, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, who's going to win? Who's going to win this face-off?
I don't know. Well, let's talk about our three criteria, Dan.
Sure.
What do we got?
Well, I mean, we'd said that we were going to define popular as some combination of commercial success and cultural relevance and longevity. And so I guess I'll just make my argument for the first Wives Club. So I think, and again, we're sort of arguing this, we're arguing the movies in relation to each other. So I'm not saying it's the most important movie of the year, but on the commercial success, it absolutely crushes Long Kiss Goodnight. So it was number 11 compared to number 46.
That is true.
So that's like a pretty...
Long Kiss Goodnight made $33 million.
And I can only guess that The Long Kiss Goodnight was much more expensive to make than The First Wives Club.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Wives Club made $105 million.
Yes. So on commercial success, I think that we have kind of a clear winner. On cultural relevance, you know, it's funny. I was reading some of the reviews of First Wives Club, and it was really not well received by any stretch of the imagination. So they have, you know, historical reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. So I was reading the Owen Gleiberman Entertainment Weekly one. I read the Roger Ebert one. I mean, I don't... It feels like the running through line for all of those reviews was just that they were a little bit sexist. And that there were... It was taken that this was pushing a little bit too far at the time, as these women took revenge on their husbands, which was the same kind of sentiment that I found in some of the reviews for Long Kiss Goodnight. So I think it was just like a very different kind of moment in time.
Yep.
I think for cultural relevance, my argument would be that like people went to see it anyway. It doesn't matter. It kind of like got pretty bad reviews and still ended up the number 11 movie of the year.
Yeah, it was a favorite movie of the year.
It's sort of a fundamentally different thing than when a Transformers movie ends up as like number 11 in the year, because people are going to see that for a very specific kind of spectacle, and this is something that's a little bit different, I think. But yeah, it has a 41% on Rotten Tomatoes, only a 6.3 on IMDb. Very strangely, Blast from the Past, which again is a demented movie, has a higher IMDb score.
I don't understand it.
And then I think, you know, in terms of longevity, I've never seen Long Kiss Goodnight on TV. I've seen First Wives Club on TV a million times. Ariana Grande did her Thank You Next performance on Ellen with two backup dancers dressed and with in all white and with the same choreography from First Wives Club. There is going to be this remake with Jill Scott that's coming out soon. It's clear that this is like something that's still kind of with us. So for I mean, you know, it almost felt a little... I think it's interesting to talk about these movies together because there are some similarities that cut across them. But it's almost a little bit unfair because I do think that First Wives Club is kind of the clear winner on this one.
Wow. Okay, so on the three categories, you know, I kind of agree with you, I guess. It's as much as I love watching The Long Kiss Goodnight, it's, you're right, it really wasn't as much in, and I think if you ask 10 people on the street, more than half of them will know about First Wives Club, and less than half of them will know about The Long Kiss Goodnight.
We can do that as a bonus episode.
Well, I don't want to talk to people on the street.
Okay, I forget it.
It's cold and it's difficult. But yeah, as far as enjoyable to watch today, I think The Long Kiss Goodnight wins by a little bit for me. But First Wives Club is a really fun movie and great to watch at any time.
You know what? I think I'm going to agree with you on that particular point. I think that if on a rainy day you gave me a choice of which to watch, I would probably want to watch The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Is that criteria number four?
No, I don't think so.
No, okay. But we should talk about that regardless. Anyway. Yeah, so I think that I'm gonna go with you on this one. I think you made a good pick. First Wives Club is going to win.
Okay. So our number one slot went to Independence Day.
Yep.
Number two slot default goes to First Wives Club.
That's right.
And then next we're going to talk about Twister versus Mission Impossible, the number two versus number three movie of the year.
Great. Tune in then.
Yeah. Any stray thoughts? Any closing thoughts?
Just that I really like that line that Brian Cox did about the dog licking his asshole.
That's it. We're done.
Great performance.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.